Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Congressional Budget Office last week released its bottom line on the latest version of the House Republicans' health care bill. The new score looks a lot like the old score. About 23 million would lose insurance. In addition, the report states that about one-sixth of the American population resides in areas where the market would start to destabilize in 3 years. That plan, voted out of the House before the Congressional Budget Office report was released, has since moved to the Senate, where it was basically dead on arrival. So what's next? That's the topic this hour. Joining us by phone is Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch, Jack Torrey. Welcome back, Jack.
Glad to be here.
Does dead on arrival mean in totality? Are there any vestiges of the House measure that could be embraced by the Senate? Is there a timeline? What's going on?
Well, first of all, whenever they use the phrase dead on arrival, it means a lot of it isn't dead yet. What it does mean is they'll try to cobble together something that can win the votes of 50 Republican senators. They only have 52, and then hope Vice President Pence can break the tie. Most people find this very difficult. The Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, has basically said, I don't know if we can get the votes, which is pretty close to admitting defeat. You have senators such as Rob Portman of Ohio who object to the idea that you're to end Medicaid expansion, which Governor Kasich in Ohio used to extend coverage to about 600,000 low-income families. The second thing is you have a system of insurance markets in the individual markets that will be based on your age as opposed to your level of income, which is not going to work as well for older people as opposed to younger people. I think one of the things that should be pointed out is this bill really doesn't impact most people. Most people get their insurance through their employer. They get it through Medicare if they're 65 and older, or they get it through traditional Medicaid if they're low income. So what this will do is this doesn't necessarily change the average person's insurance policies, but it is trying to impact the 40-odd million Americans who tend to be in and out of the market and don't work for companies that supply insurance or make too much money to qualify for Medicaid.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Columbus Dispatch D.C. Bureau Chief Jack Torrey about what's happening in Washington regarding health care reform. If you have a question or comment this hour, we're going to have two different points of view coming up, conservative-leaning and a liberal-leaning organization. Both will be represented later on in the show. The number is 614-292-8513. When you say cobble together, that's not what they were talking about when they vowed to repeal and replace last year during the election. So let's talk politics for a little while. What are the ramifications if they walk away or if they fail to get something passed by August when they take their next break?
Well, my prediction from the start has been, and you're talking about someone who 50% of the time is dead wrong, my prediction is Obamacare will be the law of the land for the next few years, because I don't believe the Republicans can come up with a replacement, and I don't believe the Republicans are willing to work with Democrats to come up with ways to fix the insurance market set up by Obamacare. This is a dramatic change in Washington. I'll give you an example. The 1970 Clean Air Act and the 1990 Clean Air Act revisions were essentially passed virtually unanimously. Both parties worked together. Both parties tried to come up with compromises that made it work. This doesn't happen anymore. In 2009 and 2010, Democrats decided they were going to pass the Obamacare bill on a party-line basis. They made no serious effort to get Republicans to vote for it. Mm-hmm. The Republicans are now saying, well, let's do the same thing. They're making no serious effort to get Democrats. The drawback is, from a political standpoint, the Democrats lost the House and lost the Senate after they passed Obamacare. The Republicans are walking into the same trap. And unless they decide that they would like to say, okay, we will fix this, because the insurance markets for the individual policies are not working particularly well. Not enough companies are involved in them. As a result, not enough young people are buying these policies. As a result, the sickest people with the highest costs are entering into those markets. It's fixable, but it requires two political parties to do something they don't like doing together anymore, which is work together.
Lindsey Graham of South Carolina has said they need a bipartisan plan. You're saying there's no chance of that, but there is desire among some of the members to start working together.
Yeah, there is.
Or there is.
Well, they say there is. But the problem is the Democrats have essentially said, unless you give up the idea of repealing Obamacare, and quite frankly, the Republican bill in the House does not repeal Obamacare. Unless the Republicans give up this idea, Democrats are not willing to work with them. Why should they? They think the law is working well. They're not going to change it just to turn it into some, conservative-oriented type thing. So there is no sign at this point that I can detect that people are seriously trying to figure out a way to put together 60 to 70 votes in the Senate to pass something. And, of course, they have the other problem. If they do get a bunch of Democrats to join on a bill in the Senate, I don't think it can pass the Republican-controlled House.
Right, which is obviously what they came out with. It was, as we said, dead on arrival. How rare is it for the House to vote on something this important without waiting for that Congressional Budget Office report card?
It's not usual, but I don't think it mattered to them. Their goal in the House was to get the bill out. I don't think they cared what was in it at some point, just so they could go back and say, we repealed Obamacare, which I have to say the House bill doesn't do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was politics driving that. They wanted to get something done. They wanted to show they could get something done. And the fact is they probably assumed the CBO report was going to be a bad report, which it was.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Republican and you're trying to come up with the sunny side of life, you can say, well, the original CBO report said only 24 million people will lose their insurance coverage. This new one says 23 million, so we're going in the right direction. It doesn't take a room right when he was running the House in Ohio. Always said that politics was about helping people. I haven't figured out how you're helping people by knocking millions of people off their coverage. And I think that's what's bothering a number of Republicans in the Senate. Do I want to take this dive?
Well, on top of that, there's something a lot of people understand, and that's the issue of pre-existing conditions. And a lot of people know somebody who was not able to afford insurance because of pre-existing conditions before, right? Who didn't also qualify for Medicaid, for low income. That is something that's probably going to go away under a Republican plan, right, at this point?
It depends if the bill, if the Republican bill in the House passed and became law, it would depend on what state you live in. The states will have the option to opt out of what's known as community ratings, which is where an insurance company takes a geographical area and sets the price based on the typical insurance person, the person receiving insurance.
Uh-huh.
States like New York, California are not going to opt out of the community ratings, so they wouldn't be impacted. There are states in the South that will jump to get out of that. What that means is that for 1 year, if you have a policy that you allow to lapse for more than 60 days, you can face higher premiums, okay? Now, those states are supposed to then set up what's known as low-risk pools, which are large numbers of people with similar health problems, okay, pre-existing conditions. And the House bill will give you about $8 billion to help cushion those costs. The drawback is there's strong evidence that insurance pools, which were in existence before Obamacare, mm-hmm. didn't work particularly well. So in essence, it depends on where you live. I couldn't guess right now what Ohio might do, but I think Ohio probably would be a little reluctant to get out of community ratings.
What do we know about the impact on Ohio, according to the CBO report?
Well, you can knock off I mean, there's some reports that get as many as a million people losing their insurance coverage or health coverage in Ohio. I think that anybody, if there's 600,000 people who qualified for expanded Medicaid coverage, that is a changing number. That's not the same 600,000 every year. But most of those people would lose their coverage. And then a number of people would probably find themselves, depending on what the state legislature does, a number of people might find themselves unable to afford insurance if they have pre-existing conditions. And quite frankly, most of us have some pre-existing condition, and unless they're really healthy like you.
Thank you. Ohio Representative Pat Tiberi told the Dispatch that House Republicans and the administration will continue to focus on additional steps they can take to restore the free market, increase choices, and lower costs. Is he talking about restoring the free market as in the pre-Obamacare free market?
No, it would be a new type of setup. Here's the Republican thinking. If you have insurance companies offering a wider variety of choices, for example, the Obamacare bill mandates 10 essential benefits that cover a variety of different needs, such as, you know, care for women during pregnancy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This bill would allow states to opt out of that and have their insurance companies offer a wider variety of plans. For example, if I were in my 20s and I wanted to buy an individual policy, I might decide to go for something that just covers catastrophic illnesses because I figure I'm never going to get sick. Older people probably want a more comprehensive bill package. This is the argument that Republicans make, that if you allow insurance companies to sell policies that don't necessarily have to provide the same mandated benefits, this will create more competition. And it will lower the cost of premiums and thus save money. It's not a far-fetched idea. I just think that you're running the risk that younger people will buy a bunch of catastrophic policies that may not cover a whole lot of stuff.
And also, I mean, as far as... Well, all right, let's talk about Senator Rob Portman. He said that he's pushing for a more gradual glide path rollback. That's his words. And protections for those with opioid addiction. How can you have your cake and eat it too with all of this stuff?
I don't think you can. I think reality is going to set in at some point. And I'm not quite sure what he means by a glide path.
Yeah, I wondered. Yeah.
Well, I haven't been able to figure that part out.
I'm visualizing an airport landing strip, but I'm not sure after that where we're going.
I might point out that sometimes even on a gliding path, planes crack up. You know, it's just I don't know where he goes with this. I think Portman legitimately, well, I know he objects to the House bill. He doesn't like what it did about Medicaid expansion.
Right.
And I think he's concerned that the way the refundable tax credits are provided to people in the individual market don't work well for older people who are between, let's say, ages 55 and 64, not quite ready for Medicare. So there's a number of problems that I think he is correctly pointed to. The problem is John Boehner has pointed out over and over again.
Former Speaker of the House, yep.
Yep. Who is just having the time of his life now that he's not having his responsibility.
He sure is.
He has pointed out, yes, Republicans know what they're against when it comes on health care, but they don't know what they're for. And you have a bill now. When you have the American Medical Association and any numbers of medical organizations saying, no, don't pass this, that's a real high mountain to climb. The simplest solution, which is the one that they'll never do, is the one that was offered, you know, 40 years ago by President Nixon, which was all companies, large and small, would insure their workers. And smaller companies would get federal assistance to help them afford those costs. That won't happen. Small business people will scream and yell, and it just isn't going to happen. But we have a system that is tied to your workplace.
Right.
You get insurance coverage, I'm sure, through WSU, I get insurance coverage through the Columbus Dispatch. And they've always been trying to work their way around this instead of just saying the obvious. If you're a company and you employ people, you insure your workers. And if it's a financial burden, the government will help you.
Well, I mean, then there's the issue, though, of the changing makeup of the workforce. A lot more people are working more jobs and patching together incomes. They're not, fewer people are working like you and I do full time for one place that can afford to give us health coverage.
Then the government should be figuring out a way to provide coverage for people who don't have 40-hour a week jobs. And again, to use the Nixon plan as an example, they were going to revise Medicaid. The people who didn't have coverage through their employer would get essentially an individual insurance policy that would be guaranteed by the government. But there's no talk about that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to figure out everything they do. What the Democrats did costs far a ton of money.
Yeah.
What the Republicans have done is just not, they're not going to cover people. And the second thing that the Republicans have done is they have tied this to cutting all the taxes that were used to finance Obamacare.
Right.
Most of those taxes fell on wealthier people or pharmaceuticals or health medical device manufacturers.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't think of a worse thing from a public relations standpoint as we're going to cut taxes for the rich so we can throw 23 million Americans off coverage. I mean, I can write that commercial in 20 seconds.
Well, before I let you go, tell me, what are the insurance companies saying about all this?
Well, the insurance companies are getting out of the individual markets, the exchanges themselves, because they say that they cost too much.
Right.
The insurance companies would like to have a greater competitive system. They would, but the fact of the matter is, so far, many companies have just given up on the exchanges because they're losing money on it. Either the federal subsidies aren't high enough, okay, or they just can't offer a competitive market. They're not getting enough younger people into the system.
Let me ask you about one other provision in Obamacare that is extremely popular across the board, and that is parents being able to insure their children until the age of 26. What about that?
That stays under the Republican House bill. That was one of the very few provisions that they were trying to restrict the number of requirements at the national level to allow the state insurance commissioners to have a greater flexibility to divide. But they didn't want to go anywhere near that because it's a very popular part of Obamacare.
And what about pre-existing conditions in children? Does that go the way of pre-existing conditions for everybody else?
You just asked a question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to.
Because remember, that was what was one of the first things that changed was pre-existing conditions for children. It was in that step-up approach they took.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, and you're going to force. I'm at my office, so I'm going to go upstairs.
You go look
that
up. All right, you look that up. You figure that out, Jack Torrey. Thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Oh, I was glad to do it, and I hope it came through loud and clear.
That's Jack Torrey, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. Stay with us. More conversation about what's up with health care in the United States going forward. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Earlier today, President Trump tweeted his hopes and dreams for health care reform in Congress. He wrote, "Hopefully Republican senators, good people all, can quickly get together and pass a new, parenthetically repeal and replace, end parentheses, health care bill. Add saved dollars." Many Republicans campaigned on repeal and replace in concert with Trump, but finding the path forward has proved difficult, if not impossible, at least at this point. We're talking about current prospects for health care reform on Capitol Hill. Joining us is Senior Project Director at the liberal-leaning Policy Matters Ohio, Wendy Patton. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Executive Vice President of the conservative-leaning Buckeye Institute, Ray Hederman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Ray, you haven't written anything recently in response to the CBO report on the first or the second House measure to repeal and replace. Can you give us your thoughts about those? I mean, it's 24 million off versus 23 million in the latest estimate of the latest version and other issues. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think CBO said it best when they said, you know, we have a great deal of uncertainty because what the second bill did is they gave states a lot of flexibility in how states can design their health insurance markets, which makes it very, very hard to model. The second thing is that, you know, the Congressional Budget Office puts a great deal of weight on the individual mandate. That's part of the reason they overestimated how many people would be in the insurance exchanges in the first ACA. And I think it's part of the reason why the 23 million is overstated.
Meaning the personal mandate is a requirement that you have insurance.
Exactly.
One way
and
or
what
the other.
And what the Congressional Budget Office has found is that several million people of the 23 million, like 4 million people on Medicaid, for example, will just, you know, not have Medicaid anymore, not even bother enrolling in the program once the individual mandate goes away. And that's because the Congressional Budget Office says the individual mandate is forcing people to buy a product they don't want. And so I think, you know, if you take a look at what's packed in this 23 million uninsured number, part of it is people are being forced to buy a product they don't want. And part of it, again, is projections in the future of CBO saying these are people that will eventually have insurance coverage if other states expand Medicaid. So it's a complicated issue, and I think CBO is doing the best they can. But I think if you take a look at their past errors, specifically in the individual market, it's probably overstating how many people might have a change of insurance.
Wendy Patton, what are your initial thoughts about the CBO reports?
Our impression of the Affordable Health Care Act has not changed since the new CBO report came out. About 5% of the market is insured on the non-group market, and there are problems in that market, and it needs to be fixed. We aren't sure. We think
these
that
are
this
the people
bill
that
doesn't.
Are insured through one of the in the exchange.
They're insured in the exchange, about 212,000 in Ohio. By far, the greater problem is that the ACA, the Republican Health Plan, dismantles Medicaid. Medicaid is a far greater component of health care in Ohio, for example. While 5% of us are insured on the non-group markets, about 212,000 in the federal exchanges, Medicaid insures more than a quarter of us, 26% of us, 3 million Ohioans. And the radical restructuring dismantles the current Medicaid program.
The expansion.
It eliminates the expansion, and it turns Medicaid into a capped block grant. It takes over 10 years, $834 billion out of Medicaid, and it exposes it to an annual federal budget process. We've already seen President Trump sweep in and take another $600 billion out of the program. By far the greater problem in the Republican House plan is that it dismantles Medicaid.
You know, Ray, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine the capped block grant is something that you like because it gives states that chance to innovate and experiment.
Exactly. And let me dispute Wendy saying the House bill dismantles Medicaid expansion.
The first House bill or the past House bill?
Okay. The one that passed. And so I don't think it does. What it does is it ratchets back the Medicaid expansion match rates, the dollars. Ohio can still expand Medicaid. What the federal government with the new House bill is saying is you just won't receive bonus money for covering Medicaid expansion population compared to the traditional match rate. And what has happened is the federal government is saying we're going to give you 90 cents on the dollar eventually.
Eventually, right.
Right. If you expand Medicaid up the income scale to cover healthy people. Traditional Medicaid, you know, for now you have healthy people that could work getting more money from the Medicaid program than traditionally needy population like women and children, the elderly. They get about, you know, 55 to 60 cents on the dollar, depending on what state you're in. And so what's happening now is the House are saying, look, we're just going to put healthy people in the same bucket as the traditional Medicaid population and let states make that decision. And I think that's the right thing to do to keep Medicaid focused on the population that deserves care, which traditionally been aged, blind, disabled, mothers, sick children, things of that nature.
What about the premise, though, of getting everybody covered in the first place, which we don't talk about much anymore, and that is it makes people healthier. And then in the long run, we have a healthier population. We have a more cost-effective population when it comes to health care. If you're taking off that middle group of people that are healthy, don't, so to speak, and don't make enough money or don't make too much money to be on what was the Medicaid strictures, what? I mean...
Yeah. So what, you know, you're talking about is how do we cover people and how do we make sure more people are getting the health care that they need? And I think, you know, we need to not conflate health insurance versus healthcare outcomes. And so, you know, again, part of
why
it...
Why not?
Because if you have health insurance, that doesn't always mean that you're getting health care. People can get health care through ways outside the insurance system. You've seen alternatives come up, ideas of, you know, direct primary care physicians where you pay a premium to a doctor to receive preventive care coverage. Mm-hmm. You also take a look, you know, studies that have come out in academia that have taken a look and said, what is the effectiveness of some of these programs? You know, what's the effectiveness of some preventive care treatments? What's the effectiveness of Medicaid? And sometimes it turns out, simply because we're saying we're insuring these people, covering them, we're not finding a difference in health outcomes. So healthcare should be focused on how do we get the best quality of health care at the lowest price and not focus as much about insurance. Insurance is a vehicle for good health care delivery.
I want to focus on Ray's comments that Medicaid is for a deserving group of people and not for healthy working people. I think that many of us forget that Ohio has become a low-wage state. In Ohio, our 12 largest occupational groups, retail clerk, janitorial, fast food, three-quarters of them leave a parent with kids eligible for and needing Medicaid coverage. These are the working poor. To imply that working poor people whose jobs do not provide medical care coverage don't need health care is a misnomer. It's not fair to those people, and it's also not fair to the economies and local communities in which they live. So I think one thing your listeners need to understand is that the Republican health care plan hurts people, hurts working people, and it hurts communities through job loss.
The changing nature of employment, it's a fact in Ohio. In fact, it's one of the reasons why they say we're not reaping the revenue benefits of expanded employment since the recession is because people are going back to jobs, but they pay less and they don't have the benefits they once did. It's just changing. Ray, what about that? I mean, this isn't like we, you know, whether you're working for a company for life and you're going to get a pension in health care or you're not.
Right. And that's why we need, I think, policies to sit there and say, how do we stimulate employment? And you go back to the Congressional Budget Office, the original score of the Affordable Care Act said that the Affordable Care Act will reduce employment in the United States. It said fewer people will be working because for a variety of reasons, partially due with the taxes, higher taxes from the ACA, partially due because people would be getting income and being paid not to work. And so that, I think, it's one of the things you talk about, you know, job loss to the local community. How can we do that? We need to make sure our public policies encourage job creation, people being able to take a job at a higher wage. And I think specifically, you need to take a look and say, how can we make sure that people have an opportunity to purchase the health care that best suits them? Before the ACA, the Ohio individual market had about 50 to 60 insurers competing. Now we're seeing only one, maybe two insurers offering coverage in Ohio counties and offering a product that working people can't afford.
How do you know? I mean, how do people know what kind of insurance best suits them? For most people, it's what kind of insurance can they afford and still put food on the table. That may not be the best insurance for them, but that's what they can afford. That's what most people are looking at.
So you take a look and say, look, here's a variety. When you have competition as a factor, you have three or four insurance benefits being able to compete and say one person may say we offer higher drug coverage. One person might say we offer richer mental health benefits. And the key is you need to have competition in the insurance market. And again, before the ACA, Ohio had a very strong, robust insurance competition, creating a variety of choice and plans, which kept premiums low for people. And now we've seen premiums increase dramatically because we've taken control from insurance from Ohio and moved it to the federal government.
My insurance premiums were increasing every year for about 25 years pretty dramatically before ACA. I don't know about you.
Oh, you know, insurance companies have premiums have been going up.
Right.
But, you know, the non-group market where a lot of this pain is being felt is basically growing up so fast that you see insurance companies dropping out of the market, and unfortunately, you see people not being able to buy a plan they need.
Wendy, you've written about the economic impact of ACA in Ohio. What is it? I mean, it has created jobs.
Yes, the healthcare industry has grown strongly in the United States really over the last 20 years. That's particularly true in Ohio. Since 2000, overall employment in Ohio has grown by, between 2000 and 2015, overall employment grew by about 0.2%. The healthcare sector, on the other hand, grew by 10%. That's where the growth of jobs has been. We saw the most robust growth in jobs in our rural counties and in our central cities, where the economies are the most fragile. We saw robust growth of jobs in Scioto, Lawrence, Dark, Putnam, Henry County. I think Jefferson County's story is the most telling, in which there's been huge loss of manufacturing jobs, but now 23% of the workforce does work in healthcare. This has cushioned job loss. I think it's also important to point out that the we're letting the tail wag the dog when we really focus in on the insurance sector component of this. Medicaid covers far more of us. In the terms of the Medicaid expansion, which covers 722,000 Ohioans, the governor did a very thorough assessment. He found that 43% of the people enrolled in Medicaid expansion were working, but they didn't earn enough to get insurance, and 75% of the remainder were looking for work. As you say, Ann, this is a Medicaid covers a churning workforce within the seasonal boom and bust of retail, the temp job that starts and stops, the plant that opens and closes.
And that's gone on forever.
That's gone on increasingly. I mean, our employment, our labor market is no longer very stable, especially in the low-wage area. So the Medicaid expansion covers working people as they churn
in
this turbulent
of private
economy.
So to say
that they aren't working is a misnomer. People are working. This is the nature of our labor market. And this is a far greater danger to health care in Ohio.
A big thing I'm pretty sure it's in the House passed plan, but I know it was in the first plan. I think it is that churn would be disregarded, that when you fall off Medicaid, you wouldn't be able to get back on it when your income lowers again.
That is how it's eliminated.
Yeah, and so what they did is they said that for the expansion population, you know, you need to have continuous Medicaid coverage, and once you're off, you know, it'd be up to the state to bring you back on at the differing match rates, whether it be the expansion match rates, 90% to 95%, or going down to the traditional Medicaid match rates. And I think, you know, what Wendy's hit on an important point on healthcare, and that is, you know, as people change jobs, it's important that health insurance be, what we call it, portable.
Right.
And that, you know, right now, traditionally, health insurance is attached, you know, through the employer. So if you change employers, you have to change your insurance. And one of the things a lot of people are unhappy about is the fact that, you know, insurance companies have been offering narrow networks, where, you know, your providers may be changing. You change jobs, you then have to change doctors.
And that's been going on for a long time. That's not Affordable Care Act.
And so one of the things that people are looking at doing is, how can you make sure insurance sticks with the person and can be portable from job to job?
But that's
not in the House bill, but I think that is one of the directions where Republicans and people believe in free markets want to go. Equalize the treatment of taxes through your employer health care benefits and the individual market.
But I want to get back to that. Hold the thought. Let's take a break, and we'll get back to it. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're continuing our ongoing series of conversations about healthcare in the United States. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the latest incarnation of congressional efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The Congressional Budget Office last week released its bottom line on the latest version of the House Republican health care bill, which, by the way, does not repeal or replace. The new score looks a lot like the old score, but 23 million would lose insurance. In addition, the report states that about 1/6 of the American population resides in areas where the market would start to destabilize in 3 years anyway. And top Republicans in the Senate have said they want to start from scratch. So what are we going to do? Still with us is Senior Project Director at Policy Matters Ohio, Wendy Patton. Also with us is the Executive Vice President of the Buckeye Institute, Ray Hederman. Questions, comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We were talking about portability. Wendy Patton, what about, you know, you wanted to say something and I had to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Yeah, thanks, Ann. The problem with portability is that many of us do not have insurance through our employer anymore.
To begin with.
Yes, and this is people at the low. Again, it's the people for whom Medicaid is very important. It's at the low end of the income scale where people are not working. They're not given shifts that are more than 30 hours a week. They don't meet the requirements for health care within their own corporations, and they also have short-time jobs. And so portability may work well for middle class and upper income jobs. For people working jobs that don't pay well, that are eligible for Medicaid, they do not have insurance. And that's why the Medicaid is so important. And it's why the dismantling of the Medicaid system is so devastating. Over the next 10 years, the block granting and capping of Medicaid would suck $834 million out of the system. When you think about the configuration of the Medicaid system, the people who are the most costly are those who are the most needy. They are seniors. They are disabled. They may be children, especially children with disabilities. While they're a small share of the market, they make up between 40 and 50% of the costs. As the block grants, which are pegged to 2016 per capita costs, as the block grants, as the population ages, as costs change, this will put pressure on each state system. And the state will look at the most costly components of their system for changes, for trimming services, and maybe for eligibility. And so for seniors, for disabled people, for children, we have to be concerned that this plan, with its block granting and capping pegged to 2016, is going to do damage most in those sectors.
Mitchell and Gahanna, you're on the air. Hi, Mitchell, you're on the air.
Morning.
Morning.
How are you doing?
Good.
So, yeah, I'm hearing this debate, and I understand that affordable health care is something that everybody wants. But I feel like, you know, the key part of that is the affordable portion. So would we need an Affordable Care Act if people were making a decent wage? Will we need to come up with a means of providing for people if everyone had the capacity to afford health care or, you know, had healthier options, even if they didn't make as much money as the other people? I think that, you know, when I look and when I see what I see on television, when I see, you know, the politicians debate these issues that affect normal Americans, I just don't feel like they have a dog in the fight. I don't feel like any congressperson who passes this bill or declines the bill is going to be personally affected by it. If my senator does pass a bill or doesn't pass a bill, he's still going to have health care, he's still going to have a working wage, and he's still going to have a job. It's just not the case with most Americans. And I think, you know, despite what side of the health care debate you're on, if you put most Americans in a Congress and they had to vote, if you put the majority of people or made it a ballot vote, I believe that health care bill would look completely different from what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I mean, people have said that, but they always make sure they say everyone but thee and me before they vote on something, right?
You know, I think, you know, our caller touched on the fact, you know, saying the affordable portion or the Affordable mm-hmm. Care Act. And I think, you know, one of the reasons health insurance is so expensive is because we have a lot of mandates. You know, the original Affordable Care Act created 10 essential health benefits that add to the cost of insurance. And, you know, one of the interesting things from the CBO score, they broke states into three groups. And they said, you know, groups that would choose to waive essential health benefits and community rating would see a very, very sharp decline in premiums in the individual market. They don't even, CBO doesn't even estimate how much, but it's over 30% annually. For states that had minor tweaks to the essential health benefits, you're looking to a 20 to 30% deduction in premiums. Those are things that can make insurance affordable that our caller is talking about. Because when you add benefits to health care, as you know, one of the creators of Obamacare, Dr. Jonathan Gruber, has talked about, when you add health care mandates, you drive up the price of premiums and make insurance much more expensive for people to be able to buy. There's a trade-off of offering benefits. You have to pay for them.
The CBO study found that across the board, all things considered, premiums would drop, but primarily because our oldest and sickest would drop out of the market. They couldn't afford it. So the drop of premiums would have to do with people not being able
not
to get
enough
to
people.
affordable care. As the caller said, we have a low-wage economy. That's the underlying problem here, is that people aren't making enough to cover their basic needs.
And the question then is, do we, as a society, think that it's the right thing to do to help them out?
And to touch on the essential benefits issue also, essential benefits included prescription drugs, mental health care, maternity care, pediatric services. All of these, depending on what state you live in, may not be included in your insurance anymore. Insurance is supposed to give you security. But if you're a woman of childbearing age, you may have to pay more for prenatal care and maternity care. If you suffer from depression, you may have to pay more for mental health care. You are no longer secure in your insurance that what you need will be covered at an affordable rate. That's what you lose in the Affordable Health Care Act, is that assurance that what you need will be covered in your insurance coverage. You'll have to pay more if you need maternity services, if you need mental health services, prescription drugs. It's all on the table, depending on what your state decides to do.
And the key part is depending on what your state decides to do. This is the MacArthur Amendment, where the idea would be, instead of Washington mandating what health care coverage is and what has to be covered, we'd go back to where Ohio would choose what Ohio citizens work for. And part of the problem in Ohio is Ohio used to have a very competitive health insurance market with very low mandates. And so people in Ohio could pick and choose affordable health insurance. We've seen premium increases 60 to 90% on the individual market because Ohio no longer has control of what types of benefits are offered and instead is subject to a one-size-fits-all in Washington. If people want individual benefits, we should decide at the state level what best suits Ohio citizens. Let people in California, let people in Arkansas find out what best suits their state's needs, because the one-size-fits-all is going to drive up health insurance costs.
But, you know, I mean, Ohio is like seven states. There's seven really distinct, you know, regions in this state. It's a very populous state. There's lots of different needs. I mean, even if the state's deciding that, it's still not fair to everybody, is it? I mean,
well, you know, you had
that's
you know,
again, millions of people you're talking about in just one state.
Well, you look at the Ohio Department of Insurance said, you know, used to have 50 insurers competing for markets in the state, and now we have counties in Ohio where you don't have a choice. You have one insurer, and hopefully, you know, some of these counties will continue to have one insurer offering a plan. That's not really choice, and that's not really fair, because you sit there and you don't have a choice. This is what you have if you want insurance in the individual market. And so, you know, if you get through, when you add these benefits, you're increasing the cost of insurance. And that's when you start getting into people dropping out of the insurance markets, driving up costs for everybody else. That's one of the reasons we're seeing such instability in the individual market.
We have instability in the individual market because politically, the insurers don't know what's going to happen next. This is artificially created.
That's now. I mean, in the last couple of years, it's been that way because they don't address the issues with ACA in Congress because they want to repeal and replace it. And now everything's up in the air.
Well, that's destabilized the market. But there are some basic needs that all of us have.
But that's not the only thing that's destabilized the market.
Oh, the political piece is not the only thing. But in Ohio, we've seen a dramatic increase in insurers leaving the market, and it is based on the political instability at this time. Ohio's market has been pretty well covered and pretty stable. We're beginning to see some of the same problems in other states as insurers say, gee, I really don't know what's going to happen next, and I really can't take this risk for my shareholders. So I still see it as an artificially induced problem here in Ohio. This is not to say there are not some things that need to be corrected within that small non-group sector that we're so focused on. You know, it's not affordable. We need to have more generous tax credits. We need to have more generous subsidies for the very poor to make that market work. There are changes that need to be made. And that's the problem that this discussion was meant to address.
But however, they're not going to make those changes. They've said that even if they can't get a bill passed out of Congress, they will not address those changes that would make things better.
Well, you know, when the ACA was put in place, a lot of these insurance subsidies, the risk corridors, were scheduled to be expired, you know, back in 2016, the last one's in 2017. So, you know, those programs are going away in the original bill because people thought that you'd have robust markets.
They would naturally emerge.
And even before President Trump, you know, announced his nomination, these markets were struggling. And that's why you're talking about, and the fixes are more money to insurance companies to allow them to underwrite people, higher individual mandates to force people to buy insurance. Because right now, the individual market, we don't have a risk pool where insurance companies want to cover. That's why companies are dropping out. That's why they're raising premiums, because that market is dying. And I think, you know, we need to sit there. The House bill is a good first step. And I think, you know, the important one of the important things is the House bill gives states flexibility over their health insurance markets again, over health insurance markets in the individual, and over the Medicaid program. It's a strong step.
The House bill does not really provide the answers yet to fix our small non-group insurance market, but it creates a huge new problem for states and for huge numbers of people by dismantling the Medicaid program. That's a much bigger problem. It doesn't answer, it doesn't focus on the direct problem, but it creates a huge new program for many, many millions more people.
Terry in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I've got a question for a guest.
Sure.
Why doesn't the U.S. follow the lead of countries like France, Germany, and England? Have a taxpayer-driven health care plan for all the people.
You mean a single-payer universal tax health care system? Cow's out of the barn as far as that goes. It's too late. That was post-World War II. That was...
I think there are two major issues. You take a look, and there have now been three states that have looked at trying to do single-payer.
Massachusetts.
Vermont. California, Colorado had a bill, and Massachusetts looked at it before, and all these states give it up once the tax bill comes due because it's so much more expensive. The second thing to remember is that single payer has very, very tight reimbursement rates on doctors, and people do not want to see their doctors get paid a lot less because afraid they might not treat them.
I think the question is, what can we afford? Can the United States, the most wealthy country on earth, afford to have healthy people and afford to allow our people access to a health system? I think that the health plan assumes we can't afford it. Instead, we need to give tax cuts. Others of us assume that we can and must afford it to create a better future for America and all Americans. And so really, it comes down to an issue around what can we afford? Is health really the first wealth, and can we afford it for all people?
What do you think, Ray?
No, I think that's right. And that's why, you know, we are a rich country. We spend a lot of money on health care because we want to be able to have the care that we need, especially when we're older. We invest in more life-saving technologies, both when we're older or in prenatal pregnancies, than any other country in the world. So as a country, we've decided we're going to spend more dollars to seek better care and coverage to extend lifespans compared to every other country in the world. And that's a decision that we could make because we are wealthy.
But many people don't have coverage or don't have access to care. And that's what our caller is asking about. Our caller may have struggled to get care in the past.
Why can't it just be like those other countries?
Like those other countries, like Ireland that you described to me once, Anne. You were ill in Ireland. You walked into a modest doctor's office.
Yeah.
You paid $50. You got, you know, a prescription and a shot, and you got better. It was a modest system, but it was able, you could walk in off the street if you were sick and get cared for. There has been renewed interest in the single-payer system. Hawaii's system works and has continued to work. There is, I think, a renewed interest.
We will continue the conversation. I hope Wendy Patton, Senior Project Director at Policy Matters Ohio, you'll continue to join us.
Thank you.
And Ray Hatterman, Executive Vice President of the Buckeye Institute, I hope you'll continue to join us as well.
Thank you. We'll do, Anne.
I wish we were done, but we are not. This will go on for a long time. Thanks to everybody for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.